This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Alan Farmer with you on today's episode of Afternoons. We are helping you out with your stress. Crucially, getting an understanding of what your stress language is, some techniques for lowering it, and speaking to one listener who thinks he has nailed it. We had a stress management consultant, CBT expert, live in the studio. Turning our attention to allergies and mosquitoes, it was your skincare clinic with Dr. Latif. House and house on hand as we crunch the numbers on Q1. How Dubai property market has been doing over the last few months, and ultimately what those numbers can tell us about the rest of the year. And in our legal clinic, it was Bianca Gracias breaking it down and offering up the hacks on how to start your business, have a legal side hustle, and everything you need to know about conducting your very own business here in the UAE. Okay, then, come on, give me a number. On a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being fully Matthew McConaughey horizontal, to 10 being that picture of Cruella de Vil behind the wheel of her car, how stressed are you? Be honest. And what's stressing you out? We're talking about this today because it's back to normal. But on hand to help, Sakshi Kaur is with us today. She's a lead for corporate wellness, KHJ educational courses, and a trainer at Open Mind Psychiatry, Counselling and Neuroscience Centre. How are your stress levels?
Oh, Helen, first of all, thank you so much for having me on the show.
You're so welcome.
My stress levels fluctuate, to be honest. Sometimes I'm completely down in the deep end. Other times I'm calm and cool as a cucumber. So it really varies.
I'm exactly the same. I'm in a really good space today because I loved Ramadan. I loved Eid, but I'm a bit of a creature of routine. So as soon as the kids are back in their routine, I know what to expect. I've got, you know, Chloe's in the booth and, you know, I'm like, okay, I can relax into this. And then you look back and go, God, I was an absolute mess a couple of days ago. What was that about? What is your own interest in stress? Why did you want to dedicate a big part of your life and career to this area?
I think for me, so growing up, touching a bit on my personal story, I've gone through quite a bit in my own life. So I feel like managing stress, especially when you're at university doing your GCSEs, like I had a brother who had cancer and he passed away.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
It's okay. So yeah, just like having lots of hardships going in my life and I had so many different stresses on my plate and just learning how to manage those is so big for me. And now that I'm at a stage I can do that, I really want to be able to share my knowledge with everyone around the world. And I think it's so important because stress is actually not considered as a mental health condition on the DSM-5. But for me, stress is a mixture of depression and anxiety, and that's how I treat it with my clients as well. So yeah, for me, it's such a massive, massive area.
Can I ask then, what is it and how does it impact our overall well-being? Because it is this kind of intangible thing, and it means different things to different people. And as you say, our resilience or our capability to deal with stress can fluctuate so, so much. But what is happening in our body when we are under stress?
Absolutely. I think, first of all, I want to start off with what stress means. I know a lot of us experience it and feel it, but what is actually stress? So the way I like to define it is stress is a natural response that motivates us to get our daily demands completed, to do the day-to-day tasks.
Which sounds really positive.
Yes, exactly. And I think with stress also, too little of it, we feel bored and demotivated. Too much of it, we feel burnt out and we feel really anxious.
But heightened.
Yes.
And I think a lot of people, and I think a lot of this is to do with world events right now and how we're responding to what's, you know, what's happening globally. I feel like a lot of people, and I would sometimes include myself in this, are feeling very heightened, very reactive, like our emotions are very close to the surface. And as you talked before about your ability to deal with stress, and that changes as we get older, as we mature, as we have more things in our toolkit. So between now and 3 o'clock, we're going to put some things in people's toolkits, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
That's the plan. If you've got any questions about stress, we're going to talk about what happens when stress stops being that positive thing, that motivator, that thing that doesn't make you feel, you know, flat. But sometimes it can go too far. We're looking at the other end of that scale. And we're going to be trying to help you work out what your stress language is. I know a lot of us know about our love languages, you know, physical touch, words of affirmation, gift giving. But you have a stress language. Why, knowing yours and maybe even your partner's could be a real game changer. Joining us in studio now from Open Minds, we've got Sakshi Kaur. She is the lead for corporate wellness, PhD educational courses and the trainer. She is really, really well versed in cognitive behavioural therapy. We're talking stress today. We were just talking earlier how it's got very negative connotations, that word stress, but actually in the right dose, it can be a motivator. It can get you out of bed. It can propel you and stop that kind of feeling of the meh.
Yeah.
However, too much of a good thing, maybe. When we get to the other end of the scale, too much stress, what is happening in our body? And can you unpack a little bit about some of the symptoms when stress, you know, is maybe holding you back?
Yeah, of course. So when we experience extreme levels of stress, our body has this fight or flight mechanism that kicks off. And that's when we go into extreme overthinking. So some of the physical symptoms you get in your body are like your heart rate increases. You can feel like sweaty palms. You get a lot of muscle tension. Some of the thoughts you have going through your head are very negative. And in cognitive behavioral therapy, they're called negative automatic thoughts, or as we like to abbreviate, called NATs. So that's also another symptom that we have of stress as well. And then going on to your emotions, you feel quite depleted, low on energy. You can have headaches, feel quite fatigued also. And then also going on to the final area, which we look at in terms of CBT, is so we've got our physical emotions, behaviors, thoughts, and our So I guess it's the way we kind of convey ourselves to other people as well. Mm-hmm. So the way we speak to people, we can feel quite irritable and say things we don't mean.
Yeah.
So that's how you realize we're completely on the other end of that seesaw of stress.
I was chatting to a friend the other day about the concept of burnout and actually how record numbers of people in the UK in particular are being signed off work with burnout because their brain is not able to function. It is literally not firing, sitting at the desk, dead behind the eyes, not productive at all. You've been in the UAE for coming up to 2 years now, and I wondered if you could maybe speak to what is stressing out people in this part of the world.
So within the UAE, it's very different to the UK. So this part of the world, when I see clients, it's a lot about financial difficulties, the financial pressure. And, you know, we all know Dubai as the glitz and glamour of the whole world. So it's kind of keeping up with those pressures and those social sort of upkeeping. You know, if you do have a bit of money and you're quite wealthy, it's about keeping up that status. And the minute you lose a little bit, it's almost like, okay, I can't afford the things I used to. And that's what I see a lot of.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like within the UAE, it's definitely, it all revolves around monetary difficulties for sure.
That's really interesting. So let's have a look at CBT. This is something that, as I said, you're really, really practiced in. For, would you mind giving us a kind of a top level description of what it is?
Of course.
How it can help with stress in particular, Sakshi?
Of course. So cognitive behavioral therapy is a practical form of therapy. So it's very different to counseling. So with CBT, you know, you take away tools and techniques and you can apply them to your day-to-day life. And how CBT works, it focuses on these four areas that we have. And those four areas I touched on a little bit before are your behaviors, your thoughts, your emotions, and your physical symptoms. And all of these four areas can turn into a vicious cycle if they're all very unhealthy. And it mainly starts from your behaviors and your thoughts. So if your behaviors are unhelpful and your thoughts are quite negative, that will then feed onto your physical symptoms and then your emotions. And that vicious cycle just keeps on continuing.
How do we break the cycle?
Yes. So how you break that cycle, of course, it's going to be in a bit of a nutshell, but you can learn like cognitive behavioral techniques. So I guess I can go through one if you'd like me to.
Yeah, well, let's think of an example. Let's think of, this is not my personal example, I hope. I'm worried I'm going to lose my job. So tying a bit to the monetary concerns you were talking about earlier, but I'm feeling insecure about me keeping this job for the next few months. That's the source of stress.
Perfect. So the situation is, so I guess what's the situation to that? So that's your thought that you're worried about. It would be the situation as, have you been told anything by someone, or is it just because you feel like you're...
There's rumours going around. Okay. There's going to be a headcount adjustment and I'm Perfect. Feeling like, you know, the boss doesn't like me.
Perfect. So I'm just going to take that into context. So I think when you started off, you said, I feel like I'm going to lose my job. So that's a thought. And the situation was the rumours that are going around. And there's this technique in CBT that I go through with my clients, and it's called thought challenging. So when we are experiencing high levels of stress, we have these negative automatic thoughts. And the thought that you mentioned was, I'm going to lose my job. So what I would say to my client is, pick your hot thought of the day. What is the thought that bothers you the most? And then what I say, take that thought to court. I've got a question for you, Helen. When you go to the court, what does a judge require?
Evidence, data.
Absolutely. It's the same with these negative thoughts. They keep tapping into our heads. So when you take that thought to court, what I want you to do is get a piece of paper and write your evidence for the thought and evidence against the thought. And once you've written all of them out, you will actually realize 9 times out of 10 that your evidence against the thought is a lot more than for the thought. And sometimes, you know, my clients say to me, well, what if I can't think of those ideas against the thought? Think about it from your friend's point of view. If you ask your friend this, I'm going to lose my job, what would they say to you? And then put that evidence down for against the thought. And once you've got your evidence, you will see that your evidence against is a lot longer than the evidence for. And then what you do, you revise that hot thought. So that hot thought at the beginning was, I'm worried I'm going to lose my job. And then looking at your evidence, you balance out and say, well, I thought I was going to lose my job, but because of this evidence, I do my deadlines on time. I attend all my meetings. I attend to work on time, all of those things. And then your thoughts revised. So it's in a nutshell. And of course, it sounds a lot easier. But when you put it into practice, it does work.
One thing that I found quite liberating, I guess, over the last few years is understanding what's in my control and what's out of my control.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And this idea, I don't know if you ever listened to Mel Robbins. She's amazing. She has this philosophy around let them. It's like, if you know, if someone's driving like an idiot, you know, halfway down the road, let them.
Yeah.
There's no point in me getting, you know, my stress levels high as I'm driving home. And that has been really, really helpful for me. And I've said it to my husband yesterday. I was like, why are you worrying about like what he's going on about and him being owed money and this and that and the other? It's like, just let them crack on. It's nothing to do with you. I know. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I bet that's come with a lot of practice, right?
Yeah, like 41 years. 41 years of practice.
Absolutely. I think even me being a therapist myself, you know, my husband's always like to me, like, just let it go. And over time, I have begun to think that way. But sometimes it's so hard to like let go of things that are not in your control because we physically can't do anything about them. But it's about understanding that every day working towards that goal.
Mm-hmm. We've got questions coming in. We've had suggestions about what helps you manage your stress levels. We're actually going to have a look at some of them because some of them form really, really good pillars to mental health and stress management. Joining us from Open Mind Psychiatry Counselling and Neuroscience Centre, Sakshi Kaur is with us today. To help reduce your stress levels right now, joining us from Open Mind Psychiatry Counselling and Neuroscience Centre, we have got Sakshi Kaur. She's the lead for corporate wellness and KHJ Educational Courses. She's a trainer and is really passionate about stress management. She uses CBT and among other techniques. And I wanted to ask you about some of the messages we've had from our listeners, because what seems to be coming through is if you get some of these pillars right, then stress might not affect you as much as it must. So, I mean, I think sleep. I just said to you off air, I went to bed at 8:45 last night.
Yes.
A little extreme. We've had messages about having a new nutritionally dense food, exercising. How integral are these aspects of daily life and daily practice for your ability to deal with stress?
I think they're very important. I think you mentioned nutrition. So when we are feeling really stressed, it's important to eat nutritional, dense food as opposed to something junk, because junk will then make you feel quite lethargic and tired and that vicious cycle continues. Whereas if you pick something that's packed with nutrients and nutritional value, for example, a salad or an avocado, something healthy, you'll automatically feel good. It releases the good hormones within your brain.
I think, and also then if you feel like you're taking care of yourself, it becomes this kind of cycle of, you know,
Self-care.
Yeah. I don't like the phrase self-care because it makes me think of people just like going for a manicure and be like, it's self-care, babes. And I'm like, it is. But, you know, it's a bigger thing. It's a bigger thing than that. Now, I have talked about, and I love talking about, the 5 love languages. For anyone who's not familiar, trust me, I can send you a podcast of this. But in the 5 love languages, it is how you give and receive love. And they can be categorized roughly into 5 ways, which is physical touch, words of affirmation, gift giving, quality time and acts of service. Now, we're now hearing that there are stress languages. What are they? And can you break them down for us?
Absolutely. So, like you said, we've all heard of love languages. Stress languages play a massive, massive role. Before we get onto that, I do want to say that stress languages shouldn't be used as a label or as a blame to your partners, to your friends or family members. So that's my disclaimer out there. But stress languages are essentially how we...
Oh, we've got a caller. So before we break it down, because maybe we can help out this caller. and see if we can talk through what they are going through and establish it. How are you? Alex is on the line.
Hey, Helen. Hi, how are you? Sorry, I forgot the name of your guest.
Sakshi's here. How can we help you?
So, about managing stress, I've learned how to manage my stress almost too well, to a point where I became almost numb to things, good or bad, right?
Interesting.
The issue is that I've realized, because of learning how to manage my stress, I became a source of stress for others around me, because they don't understand how I'm not reacting to things. And then they reflect their more stressful behavior because of the way I've reacted to whatever is being brought to my table with more stress. And then it makes me just basically walk away. And when I say managing stress, I don't even feel one bit of heart rate increase or anything to almost anything, whether in the street, whether road rage, whether work, whether whatever the case is. I've learned that stress does not solve a problem. But then I became a source of stress to the others around me.
So they're getting frustrated that you don't respond or react to stressful situations.
Well, I do respond, but I don't respond the way they want me to be.
Or what they expect.
The magnitude of the problem that they bring. And because I became so numb, almost have zero reaction to things. So, for example, one of my friend's father passed away recently. And usually I would, if this was 3 years ago or 4 years ago, I would even have the slightest feel to it. Mm-hmm. But then when you learn how to deal with your stress, you look at things from a logical point of view, and you try to think, for example, were they ill? Was this a relief? Mm-hmm. More than so you became well grounded that other people think that you are from a different planet. That's what I'm trying to say.
No, I completely get what you say. So you are now kind of very level-headed, stoic, pragmatic. You use the word logical there. You're asking your message, do you have a name for this? So actually, is there a name for this?
Do you know what? There's not actually a name to this, but it's really interesting to hear how you've managed your stress so well that now others are perceiving it as, I guess, an annoyance to an extent. I guess, how long has this been going on for? It's quite interesting.
I would say for a couple of years at least.
And can I ask you how you manage your stress? So let's think about the road rage situation. So, and I have to say, proper wacky races on the road today on my way to work. What's going through your mind, and what was maybe going through your mind when you were learning how to deal with that stress? What kind of stories were you telling yourself, or what strategies were you using, Alex?
I first started to identify the problem of road rage in that example, and I asked myself, am I being hypocritical when I criticize drivers because I've done a road rage myself, or I've done I've driven.
Done a dodgy maneuver in your time, yeah.
We all have, right?
Same thing.
The second thing I've asked myself, if I would get frustrated at certain type of cars that gives me an indication of a financial or a status of a person, but I don't react to certain cars because of their status in society, it makes me a hypocrite. So either I will react to all or react to no one. And then the third thing that I had to think about is that whoever's driving bad on the street, either they're ridiculously dangerous or in a hurry, and for both of those reasons I should move away. Mm-hmm. Because if they're dangerous, they're dangerous to me and themselves, and if they're in a hurry, they're in a hurry for a valid reason. Mm-hmm. And then for those, so once I dissect that situation, and I dissect every situation this way, and then I realize that I don't need to react. I basically come to a conclusion, and I conclude that from now on, similar situations I will not react to because of the 1, 2, 3.
Wow. Okay. So actually, we've only got a minute before the traffic. What's your take on this, and any words to Alex and I guess those around him?
Sure. Alex, I feel like you're really rational, and I think to get to that stage, it does take a lot of time. So you actually dissect and rationalise, you know, what's going on the road, which is super.
And for that to become quite an automatic reaction rather than a kind of, I'm going to sit down and work this out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I could learn a thing or two there.
Same.
But I think it's really interesting. Like, we are going to be talking about stress languages in a little while. So I think when you understand what other stress languages are, you can then respond to that. And therefore, then perhaps the people around you, your close loved ones, don't feel that sort of annoyance or frustration. I think it might be a bit helpful.
All right, Alex, we are going to be talking about, and you said before, you're kind of numb, which is one of the, one of the stress languages. Alex, thank you so much for your time. Really interesting. You sound like Yoda. Teach us your ways. Write a book. Okay, and then you can come on as an expert. You're a star. Thank you so much, Alex, for being in touch. Really appreciate it. When we come back, we're going to be having a quick rundown of the stress languages. Are you a fixer, a denier, or maybe a nummer? Joining us now to help beat the stress, we have got Sakshi Kaur. She is joining us from Open Mind Psychiatry Counselling and Neuroscience Centre, an expert in CBT. And we're talking about not the love languages, but the stress languages. There are five. Let's go through them. We've got the exploder, the imploder, the fixer, the denier, and the nummer. I feel like exploder is the one that needs the least explanation. So if someone is super, super stressed and that's their stress language, what happens?
So the exploder, essentially, you can see it pretty visibly. They're angry, frustrated, a bit of aggression, and eventually it can lead to them storming out of the room. That's what the exploder looks like.
Mm-hmm. The imploder?
So the imploder is quite opposite. Oh, just going back to the exploder, actually, there's a lot of blame to other people. So the exploder kind of blames external situations or external people. Going on to the imploder, it's pretty much the opposite of the exploder. So they kind of internalize their stress. They don't really share it with other people, and there's a lot of self-blame. They also feel quite helpless and hopeless as well.
So that kind of narrative, or I always do this, I'm so stupid, why does this always happen to me? Yes. That kind of thing.
Absolutely, yeah, which kind of like hones into like low self-esteem a little bit as well.
Okay. Then we have the fixer. So I'm guessing, I mean, the fixer sounds really positive. So going in, trying to sort out a situation, what's the root cause of all the stress, da-da-da-da-da. But is there a danger of maybe overstepping boundaries and a bit of a bull in a china shop?
Absolutely, yes. So with a fixer, you know, to begin with, it sounds great. You can come up with solutions. How do we fix this? How do we solve this? But like you said, later on, it can get a little bit annoying for the other person. So you're overstepping boundaries. And also, you're not trusting your partner's capability to fix certain things.
Oh, I guess I'm
guilty of that.
I think I might be married to one of those. We've also got the denier. So everything's fine. I'm fine. Everything's fine. Like Ross and Friends and the fajita situation. Okay.
I think the denier also comes from, it's a common pattern of, I guess when that individual's younger, the parents tell them or they've been taught that you shouldn't show signs of stress. Stress isn't really real. And I know that happens in certain cultures more than others. Mm-hmm. Mine being one of them, you know, stress is not real. Like, why are you stressed for? So the denial is like, I'm fine. Everything's okay. Things could be worse. But they eventually lead into becoming the imploder or the exploder.
Lastly, we've got the nummer. So a master in the art of distraction, perhaps a little bit. So, I mean, there's the obvious, you know, abusive substances. Yep. But could that also be throwing yourself into work, screens?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so it can look positive to us on the outside looking in. But if you're overworking or overexercising, that's also not good.
Last question to you. If for everyone listening today, for you as a stress management expert, what would you love everyone to do less of, do more of, adjust? I guess your number one tip for reducing the stress in our lives, or if not reducing the stress in our lives, but our ability to deal with it.
How long do I have, Helen?
About 20 seconds.
Okay, so I think for me, the important thing is have a balance of activities. I know you probably don't categorize them, but routine, necessary and pleasurable activities, balance them. When we're stressed, one can be higher than others, but we need a balance of all three. And that's how I'd love to sum it up.
Thank you. For anyone who wants to contact you, whether it's about corporate wellness or indeed one-on-one help, what's the best way of getting in touch?
You can go onto the Open Minds website and you can contact me through there.
Tell you what, we'll make it even easier. If you want to send me the word stress, I will send you Sakshi's details. You can find out a little bit more. We love introducing you to the experts, and we've got one joining us on Teams today. He's often actually in Dubai. Dr. Fahim Latif is a consultant dermatologist and allergy specialist. He practices between Leeds in the UK and here in Dubai, where he is at King's College Hospital. How are you, Dr. Latif?
I'm very good, thank you, Helen. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you. I'm sorry I missed your latest trip to Dubai. Were you one of the many people affected by the constant slap mosquito action that everybody's so angry about right now?
No, I managed to escape that, thankfully, but I have been afflicted before.
Oh my gosh, my literal favourite hobby right now is running around the house with the kind of the electric tennis racket. It's become my main source of cardio, to be totally truthful. There is a crazy number of mosquitoes. We are going to talk a little bit about why some people suffer, and maybe mosquitoes see you and just buzz off. Let us know if you are struggling. Before we get to that, though, Doctor, can I ask you, where did your interest in allergies and dermatology start from? Why was this an area of medicine that you wanted to focus on?
So I think there were a number of reasons. I always say to the juniors, I feel like dermatology is one of the sort of best kept secrets in medicine. I think the nice thing about dermatology and, you know, skin problems is you can actually see the condition that you're treating. With a lot of other specialties, it can be hard to actually, if you're a cardiologist, for example, you can't see what's going on and such. And the benefit of that is you can see the improvements that you can make. And there's, I think, a strong link between sort of skin disease and mental health in particular. And that's one of the things that I have really seen the benefit of our treatments in, and how much it can change a person and give them that confidence and improve their mental health. And that, and the other thing about dermatology is we treat all kinds of conditions. It's probably one of the specialties with the most number of potential diagnoses. And we treat children, infants, and right up to sort of 90-year-olds, 100-year-olds patients. So it's there's never a dull day.
And never a same day twice. I think that speaks to actually a really interesting point about mental health. And I say this as someone who had terrible eczema as a kid, really, really bad, and thankfully grew out of it. But actually, at university, made a documentary about eczema sufferers and just how much it was holding them back from doing what they wanted to in life, from, you know, going out, feeling confident in job interviews, you know, starting relationships. And whether it is, you know, acne, psoriasis, eczema, all manner of things that you treat, to, yes, of course, transform their skin, but to have someone come back into your clinic, you know, with their head up and a smile and this renewed sense of confidence, it must be really, really, really rewarding. So thank you for your time today. As I said, you are speaking to us from the UK. We've had a couple of questions, one about lupus and about skin flares. We've had another about the gold standard of allergy testing for, you know, skin issues and, you know, reactions. But before we get to that, can I ask you, why might some people get a reaction to a mosquito bite and others have zip? What do we know?
So it's a really good question, and it's a common thing that we do get asked. And it actually pertains to the way that your body's immune system reacts to the protein. So when a mosquito bites you, the saliva has a particular protein in it, and the way your body reacts to that will differ from person to person. So if you have a very hypersensitive immune system, you will get a strong allergic reaction. So you might have become sensitized, and then from that day onwards, you start having problems with mosquito bites, having previously not had a problem. So someone who doesn't experience an issue, their immune system is just not triggered by that protein in the same manner that somebody else is.
Can it change? Because I remember going out for dinner in Dubai about 10 years ago, and it was at a place where there were loads of mosquitoes. It was a body of water in downtown. That's all I'm going to say. And I woke up the next morning with, and I counted them. I sat and counted them, about 160 bites, but knee and down on both of my legs. And I was nearly in tears. I had to put socks on, had to, you know, all the drugs. Now I don't get bitten at all. Does anything change in your body composition? Is it, you know, hormonal? You know, can it be dietary changes or just growing out of it? Bit of good luck.
So there's probably a couple of points there. So sure, things can change in your body. So it's basically anything that changes your immune response. And I think we'd seen during the pandemic, for example, that having COVID or sometimes the immunizations themselves, whether they're childhood immunizations or the COVID vaccines, that can change how your body reacts to certain external stimuli. But the other question here, obviously, is the protein the same? So was it the same kind of mosquito variant that bit you? Was it a different one that your body may have reacted to in a different manner? So I think it's always difficult to answer that without knowing what exactly bit you, but that those are the kind of considerations. So absolutely, anything that can change your immune response do include things like stress, hormonal changes, because there is stress on the body. So all of those can, but it's a very difficult thing to discern, especially retrospectively. Yeah.
Right, we've got questions galore coming in now on the topic of skin. Joining us, Dr. Fahim Latif had a message saying, my three-year-old has eczema on the side of knees and thighs. There's a big trend that it's caused by food allergies. Is that true? We'll be finding out. As I said, we've had a question about skin flares relating to lupus as well. And a message saying, I need some treatment for severe and resistant acne. We're going to have a quick fire round on the text line.
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Joining us now, speaking to us from the UK, but Dr. Latif actually treats people there in Leeds, but also here in Dubai, where he practices at King's College Hospital. We're talking allergies, skin, and more. How do you feel about a little quick fire round on the text line, Doc?
That's fine. Now go ahead.
Let's do it. A message here saying, my wife has lupus and skin flares now and then. She gets the butterfly rash on her nose area, especially when she's stressed out. Any solutions? And this is going to be a kind of a bigger practice than just dermatology and allergies, presumably. But something come to mind when it comes to the skin aspect of a condition like lupus?
So lupus is actually an autoimmune condition. So usually your body's immune system fights against bacteria, viruses, that sort of thing. But sometimes it gets confused with parts of your own body. And that's what's happening in lupus. Now, there's different types of lupus. You can get skin lupus or systemic lupus, which is what this patient sounds to have, because typically the butterfly rash is associated with other symptoms like joint aches and shortness of breath. And sometimes it's more than dermatology, more than skin. They might have to see a rheumatologist as well. And often the way we would treat the skin would be to use something that suppresses inflammation, which would be either steroids or something called calcium urine inhibitors like Protopic or Elidel. We also have tablet treatments that sort of take the inflammation down much on a much broader scale. So I think as a first point of contact, they'd probably be worth seeing a dermatologist and a rheumatologist. Obviously, having the diagnosis confirmed is very important, which can be often be done with a blood test, mm-hmm. But sometimes you need a skin biopsy.
Okay. Obviously, Dr. Latif is out of the UAE right now. When he's back, he is in Dubai, but there are some fantastic dermatologists at King's as well in his absence. Mira says, hi, my three-year-old has eczema on the side of knees and thigh. There's a big trend now saying it's caused by food allergies. Is that true?
So I would say that's not true. So it's not food allergy that would cause it. So a food allergy would present with immediate swelling of your lips or a hives type of a rash rather than an eczema type of rash. So typically your nut allergy patient is the common example. However, food can play a role in chronic inflammatory conditions like eczema. So if you're eating things that are pro-inflammatory, so that would be things like sugars, processed foods, carbohydrates, certain things like dairy, that could increase inflammation and potentially make your eczema worse. However, if you treat your eczema, that doesn't tend to happen as much. But there is another type of allergy that is much more relevant to the eczema, which is a contact allergy, which is the kind of testing that I've introduced at King's College, which hasn't been done very well in the UAE previously. And that's looking at things that go in contact with your skin. So that could be preservatives in your personal care products. It could be textile dyes, which could sometimes account for those areas. So there's lots of things that often people don't think about because it's not an immediate reaction. So you use a personal care product and then the eczema flares up a few days later, making it really hard to figure out unless you have the patch tests, which is the ideal test for this.
And when it comes to children in particular, my gosh, having been there myself as both a child and as a parent, how young can children be to have that kind of testing, Dr. Latif?
So I think we've tested people as young as 2 or 3 years old. I mean, the difficulty is for the child to be able to keep the patches on. So they just have to be able to comply with instructions. It's a little bit uncomfortable when you take the patches off, but we have had positive reactions in as young as 2 and 3 year olds. But, you know, that is not the norm. You know, you'd expect that people would be exposed to things for a while before they become allergic. So it's usually seen in slightly older. But if there's a high level of suspicion, then we would definitely test.
Message here saying, I need a new treatment for severe and resistant acne. I don't know what treatment this, I know it's a female patient, I'm not going to say her name. But when it comes to acne treatment, what would you say? Well, first of all, how do you establish what somebody needs? And what are some of the best, to your mind, treatments for, as this listener says, severe and resistant acne?
So, yeah, obviously, we'd have to take a very detailed history to make sure we're not missing anything, because, you know, acne is effectively caused by your hormones working on these oil glands called sebaceous glands that sit on your face and sometimes on your chest and back as well. And they produce this oil that blocks your pores, and then there's a bacteria that gets drawn towards it, and all of that produces the spots. So you have to direct your treatments on the oil gland to stop the oil from being produced. Now, it's important to make sure that you haven't got any conditions like polycystic ovarian syndrome that might be making your hormones go out of whack, or that you're not on a contraceptive pill that might be contributing. So those are little simple things that you can do. But effectively, what you need is a retinoid, a vitamin A medication that dries out your oil glands. Now, that could be topical, but if it's very severe and resistant, typically an oral retinoid, the most common one that people are familiar with in terms of brand name is Accutane or Roaccutane, and that is the most effective treatment for acne. And you know, there's a lot of concerns about side effects and things, but actually, when it's used properly in safe hands, on an appropriate dose, it works very effectively with minimal sort of side effects. So she may be a good candidate for that, but we have other treatments as well, depending on sort of the background and what she's tried already.
Thank you, Dr. Leaf. One very last question, saying, and it could be a quick yes-no answer. Do you treat nails? A very healthy 61-year-old woman. Last 2 years, my nails become really brittle, have ridges, which add to the breakage. Are there any treatments for this? If not you, what kind of expert do you think could help with this listener?
So as dermatologists, we do treat nails as well. We treat the skin, hair and nails. Now, interestingly, this kind of condition can be caused by allergy. So it's if she's using gel, shellac or acrylic nails, this is a way that an allergy to methacrylates can present. If she has a family history of psoriasis, this could be a manifestation of psoriasis. But also, there are multiple other causes as well. Certain medications can cause it. So, yeah, we getting the diagnosis is always the main thing, correct, you know, because if you haven't got the correct diagnosis, it doesn't matter what you use to treat it. So I think that's the primary objective really here.
We've had loads of people asking, when are you back? So that's my last question to you, Dr. Teve. I know you've just left the UAE a few days ago, but when are you back here to be conducting some of those contact
tests? I'm planning
to come
every 6 weeks or
Amazing.
So probably it'll probably be in May, my next trip, so in a few weeks' time.
In the meantime, with your permission, if people want to send me the word skin, can I send them your Instagram to have a catch-up with some of the things you're talking about and obviously your dates for Dubai? Would that be all right?
Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you
Amazing.
Very much, Ellen.
Thank you for your time. Wishing everyone who is struggling with the bites the very best. Stay calm, carry on, get an electric tennis racket. Dr. Teve, really appreciate your time and we'll speak to you very soon indeed. If you want his details, you can send me the word skin to 4001.
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis or treatment.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer on Dubai Eye 103.8.
With House and House, 10 years of unlocking opportunities in Dubai real estate.
Crunching the numbers now. Charlie Bannon's in the studio, Managing Director at House and House. We're having a bit of a review of Q1, Dubai's real estate market. What's been going on and how can these numbers inform us make some good decisions for the rest of the year? How are you, Charlie?
Very well, thank you.
I love crunching numbers. I find it really, actually, that's not true. I love hearing other people crunch the numbers. I'm like, here's an Excel spreadsheet. Can you tell me what this means? So last week, you revealed your market report looking across around 27 Dubai communities. Now, let's put the numbers aside for a second. In terms of the feel of the market, chat in the office, you know, how many people are getting some nice suits and smiling around your gaff right now? How do you feel like Q1 has been?
Yeah, it's really good. The sentiment's really strong. Obviously, the House and House has grown, so there's more brokers in the office. That naturally builds the numbers anyway. But I think if you look across the board, all the agencies and the market as a whole, it's rising. There's more transactions. The growth in AED build is higher. So across the board, it's strong.
Up, up, up. We're going to be having a bit of a deep dive into where it's going up and also the particular properties as well. Can we start with villas? You know, which areas have we seen some really high growth villas and why?
Well, sitting around 36% year on year comparison, Q1, you've got Jumeirah Islands, Jumeirah Park and Sober Heartland.
Wow. Sober Heartland.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting? Because I guess we all kind of live in these little bubbles of like, oh, my friend lives here, my friend lives there. I don't know anyone that lives in that area, so it's not on my radar at all. And yet, massively delivering.
Yeah, and I think that's what's crucial when it comes to working with real estate brokers in the market, because you get a sense of not only for what's ready here now, but looking into the future a little bit, as probably lots of brokers have been speaking about for the last 2-3 years, it's now all coming into fruition, same as Slough or Gaff.
And why those areas in particular? Why do you think we've seen that kind of number?
Well, I think if you look at Jumeirah Islands, the developer Nikhil, they're very open to changing the facade of property, which is really good when it comes to renovation.
Yeah, very appealing.
Exactly. And then you've got Jumeirah Park. I suppose areas like Jumeirah Park, if you look previously at what areas have done well, Dubai Hills Estate, Arabian Ranches, Emirates Living, once the prices are pushed up in one community, buyers are then looking for another community, maybe from an affordability perspective, which creates a bit of a buyer frenzy now arguably in Jumeirah Park, which then pushes the prices up.
So that ripple effect, and that can be a geographical thing or it can be a price point thing of looking for sort of a similar offering in that price point. But gosh, well, good for you guys. If you were there a year ago, 36% up in Jumeirah Park, Jumeirah Islands and Sober Heartland. I've heard amazing things about the apartments actually in that part of the world in terms of huge double height windows and really cool architectural features. So let's talk apartments. Which part of Dubai have we seen the highest price growth for apartments, Charlie?
In the Greens at 28%.
Wow. Wow, really? Now, are we talking old greens or new greens? Are we talking like
old greens? The new greens is the views. This is the greens.
Wow. 28% in the greens.
Yeah. A lot of that's coming from renovation.
Okay. So
if you look a year ago, lots of properties, like one bedrooms, maybe selling under a million dirhams. Lots of people have come in and renovated those properties and now they're pushing up 1.25, 1.3. So that's really in line with probably what people are doing to the properties in the community to drive the prices.
And do you think the people that are buying those properties, renovating them, are living in them or they're doing it for rental purposes?
To flip.
Flip. There you go. So, which leads me to ask, which areas have seen the highest rental yield?
Villas, you're looking at the Mac Hills, just under 6%, 5.93%. And then apartments, District 1, at 7.78%.
Wow. That's very tidy indeed.
Yeah, it's strong, right? And I suppose in every community, you can probably find similar returns. Mm-hmm. But obviously, our market reports just show, obviously, all of the data, and they're the two that pop out. But it's safe to assume that in most communities, you could find similar returns. It's just finding the right opportunities to buy.
We're going to be talking about those opportunities. What can the numbers from Q1 teach us about the rest of 2024? Joining us in studio from House and House is Managing Director Charlie Bannon. We're going to be looking next about some which areas of kind of transacting high and low? Low, maybe not, maybe low is the wrong word. How has the Dubai property market performed overall in sales and rentals as well? And which areas, crucially, are the ones to look out for?
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer on Dubai Eye 103.8.
With House and House, 10 years of unlocking opportunities in Dubai real estate.
We are reflecting on Q1 of Dubai's real estate market with Managing Director Charlie Bannon now. They recently revealed their report, and you can find that on the House and House website if you want to have a bit of a deep dive into some of the communities, into some of the numbers. But we're giving you the top line now and answering any questions that you would like to put to Charlie. So we said, you know, it's been a really, really positive quarter. What about where are the areas? And I think a lot of people, you know, renting, listening now, where have we seen the highest increase in rents in the city, Charlie? What do the numbers say?
Highest increase in rents have been across Dubai Hills Estate, Jumeirah Park and Dubai Marina.
And the lowest. I don't think the lowest is actually a conversation that we're able to have right now, to be honest. I think it's all up, up, up. So in terms of areas to look out for, where are your ones to watch? And I guess you can do this in a couple of ways. You can do this as in, where is it worth investing now that we're expecting to see some really good returns, whether you're looking to flip it or, you know, longer investment down the line, but also the ones where you can perhaps bag a bit of a bargain on rent. If your best mate just moved to Dubai, where would you be, which direction would you be pointing them in, Charlie?
Well, I mean, look, if you look in, goes back to our conversation a moment ago, if you look at communities like District 1, Sober Heartland and Salah Al Ghaf, they're the communities that are sort of up and coming and over the next 1 month to 3 years and going to become more and more in the public eye. And you will have friends that live there and reside there. And, you know, that's where potentially you can get much more capital depreciation and obviously a strong rental return.
Message here saying, Damak Lagoons, would love to hear your opinion. Off plan have gone up 30% in 12 months. Hype or justified?
Well, if people are buying it, it must be justified. So it's hard to say it's hype if it's factually correct. I suppose Damak Lagoons, they're a huge developer. And if you look at what they've planned to do in the community with all of the CGIs and whatnot that they've shared, it looks fantastic. Mm-hmm. So obviously, dependent on what it looks like once it's handed over, I suppose that will be the final factor as to was it hype or was it justified. But on paper, yeah, it looks good.
Looks great. And I knew we were going to get this question, and Uzair has delivered. When can we expect a price correction? I don't even know what price correction means anymore. In terms of where we are on the up and the down, I have got no idea where we are. What does that mean to you? And what would you say to anyone who's kind of clinging on to the promise of a so-called price correction?
I suppose when people say price correction, they're asking, when's it going to start coming down? When's it going to be a dip? When can I buy something and save a little bit of money? But I suppose to really simply answer the question, when are people going to stop coming to Dubai? Because if people continue to move to Dubai, they need a home to live in, whether they rent or whether they purchase. And obviously that puts pressure on supply versus demand. Mm-hmm. And it's in the favour of people that own property in this market that it's going to continue to rise. Obviously there's lots of off-plan being sold, but obviously that's not going to affect the supply in the market for a number of years. And often that's not on time, so there's a delayed response to the market. So provided that Dubai keeps incentivizing people and making it easy for them to come here and want to live here, it's arguable as to this huge question mark as to if there's going to be a correction anytime soon.
Do not make me sing Yaz, The Only Way Is Up. I wish I had it on a button to play to you. Charlie Vanden, thank you so much for your time. For anyone that does want to contact you, you can just send me the word property. I'll happily send you Charlie's details on the House and House website. Also on that website, you will find the full breakdown. They have got their Q1 real estate market report across 27 Dubai communities. What is up? And you can crunch some of those numbers yourself. 4001 to get Charlie's details. Thank you so much. Really appreciate your time as ever. Have a good one and we'll see you soon. We are hooking you up with hacks galore this afternoon. Setting up your business, having a legal side hustle, talking visas and more, with the managing partner of Crimson Legal, Bianca Gracias, in the studio. I was going to say to you, did you have a nice relaxing Eid? But you've got your own business. Business never stops. How are you?
Very well. Thank you very much for having me. I think this is my relaxing session.
I'm here for you. I'll put on my relaxing voice. You're going to be working hard this hour, my dear. We've had lots of questions. We are talking about business licenses and setting up costs, visas. And I think a lot of people, I mean, certainly think post-pandemic, have thought, I want to be my own boss, or I, you know, financially need to start working, or I need to have a side hustle. So we've seen a huge explosion in companies offering these services, Dubai making it easier to access this. But I also feel like we've got an awful, awful lot of confusing information. So we're here to kind of cut through it today. So I guess I want to start with was one of your top line issues is, how do you select the best license for the business that you want to start? What advice do you give there?
An excellent question to start with. So the first question you need to ask yourself is, what is my activity? What am I thinking of selling now? And what is this activity going to be 3 years from now? Mm. Who my demographic is? Don't think about where is the cheapest place I could set up a license. That is really not the place you want to go. It's like a rabbit hole if you go down there. So find out ideally where you want to set up your license. We've got over 60 options to choose from in the UAE.
60?
Yeah, you've got a lot of options, and getting the right advice matters. It really matters. And I always recommend going and speaking to a lawyer, not an agent, because lawyers are impartial, ethical. They will give you the right advice without receiving any commission or being biased. Unlike an agent.
When you're talking about where you're going to be in 3 years' time, is that to do with choosing the business activity that you put on that license? And are you able to change that activity as your business grows and progresses?
You can change, you can add, depending on what kind of category you are. So you can group similar activities together. But the one thing you need to bear in mind is that free zones are limited with their activities. Whereas in mainland, you have more options. So there are limitations, whether you go with a free zone option or the mainland option. You just need to understand what is the right activity you're going for. What is your business plan? 99% of founders that I meet don't have a business plan. They don't know what they're going to do with their business.
Here's a question that we get quite a lot is, when do you need to have a business license? So you have an idea, you've had a bit of fun in Canva, you've set up your logo, might have done a landing page on a website, when do you need to have that license in place? Do you need to already be making money? Or is it a case of no money should be crossing your palm until you've got that piece of paper?
Exactly. No money should be crossing your palm before you've got that piece of paper. So, because every commercial activity in the country, just like any other country, is regulated.
Mm-hmm. What about the tax question? That's what we're going to come to next. We had a message asking if you have got a DED license, do you need to be registered for tax? We've had messages about golden visas. We've had messages, as I said, about registering for corporate tax, about leaving a business license and visa provider early. Is that possible? They feel like they're being ripped off with fees. More from Bianca from Crimson Legal next.
Dubai I 103.8 presents an array of independent expert opinions and does not advise one particular view. Always seek independent legal advice which considers your own personal circumstances.
It's a business setup special, from being a one-man band to world domination. What do you need in place to make sure you're conducting your business legally? Joining us from Crimson, we've got the managing partner, Bianca Gratius, on hand. We've had lots of questions for you, Bianca. We're going to try and get through as many as possible. You mentioned before about how to choose the best business license, and you touched on this, free zone versus mainland. What are some of the pros and cons of each side, and who's eligible to set up in those jurisdictions?
Well, your eligibility really depends on the kind of activity that you're looking for. There are some activities that are not available in certain free zones. There are some activities that are restricted only to UAE or GCC nationals. So it really depends on your activity and who your demographic is. If you're trying to trade in products or services on the mainland, then setting up in the free zone may not be the best option for you. You will need to consider the mainland.
Message here saying, if I want to, say, repair cars and 10 free zones let me do this and they all cost about the same, how do I choose between them?
It depends on where your garage is going to be set up. If your garage is going to be set up, say, in Jabal Ali Free Zone, no problem at all. People will bring their cars to Jabal Ali Free Zone. But if you want to set up a garage in mainland, say in Al Quds, for example, in Dubai, and you have a JAFSA license, then you can't really do that.
Okay. So geographical factors as well. What about e-commerce, online? What do you tend to advise? Because that can be the real challenge is... We touched on this earlier. When do I do this? Because I'm not making money, so now it's hard to spend the startup costs. The DED Cafe, I think, has been a huge, huge help to an awful lot of kind of aspiring entrepreneurs who maybe don't need a visa necessarily. They just need that trade license. When do you need a visa? And how does that work with kind of scaling up if you need to add visas to your business?
So the one thing everybody needs to understand, or entrepreneurs need to understand, is a visa allows you the right to stay in the country, be a resident, whereas a business license allows you to trade, make money, if you will, and commercialize your activity. So if you're trying to commercialize your activity, start making money, then that's the right time to go get a license for yourself. You can start with an e-trader license, but the one thing that I always like to advise is, with an e-trader license, you can't get a visa. Mm-hmm. You can't get office space. You can't hire people. And it only really legalizes your activity online. And the liability is unlimited. Your liability is personal and it's unlimited. Unless, of course, you're contractually limited.
Bianca, a question here from Marshall saying, how about freelancer visas? This is another space that's changed an awful lot in the last kind of 5 to 10 years. What do freelancers in particular need to know about? Well, I mean, also the cost range is enormous for freelancers as well. How on earth do you go about choosing that?
So the thing with freelancer visas is, again, freelancer visas give you the right to stay in the country and they legalize your activity. It doesn't really allow you to go and lease office space, hire more staff if you need to. So it puts you in that tricky position. And the cost of freelancer visas, if you weigh it against the cost of setting up, say, in a free zone, for example, you'd rather go and get a limited liability company license instead of a freelancer visa, which allows you then to also sponsor, get additional staff, lease a property for your office, etc.
Okay, makes a lot of sense. Jen from Female Fusion has been in touch. Hi, Jen. She's saying, can you please ask Bianca to talk about the most important legal documents that a small business should have in place? I see so many businesses think they don't need anything, and then this can end up costing them money in the long run. Yes. What should be on your checklist?
Hey, Jen. Very good question. The main question to ask yourself first before you think about contracts is, where are my relationships, who are my relationships with, and where are my risks coming in? If you have a list of what if, what could go wrong in my business? What if this happens?
All right. What if it's hugely successful and it needs to be going in a different direction, but yeah, covering your back.
But have a plan B in place. If you understand where your risks are coming in from, that's essentially where you need to lock in and have your contracts in place. Mm-hmm. So the essential contracts that you're looking to have in place are with your suppliers, with all your employees, your suppliers, your freelancers, interns, and any third parties that you contract with, essentially.
What about things like, I'm just thinking about like ID documents, you know, marriage certificates, birth certificates, you know, things like that. What kind of things do you need in order to set up a license? What would they be asking for?
So the essential documents that a free zone or a mainland regulator would essentially ask for is your proof of address and your main identity documents. They really wouldn't go down the route of asking any more than that. Say, for example, marriage documents, they wouldn't ask for. But they want to know if you say you are who you are really are and where you reside, where you live, etc., and if you have an Emirates ID.
What about, I'm just trying to anticipate questions coming in. What about people, and I'm thinking about women in particular, who are on their husband's visa who want to start a business? Do you need to get an NOC from your husband?
Yes.
Okay.
Fortunately, unfortunately, yes.
Okay. Bianca Grethius with us through until 5 o'clock today. As I said, lots of questions. I've had messages about being consultant, trainer or coach. I've also had questions about going on to golden visas. It's all coming in on 4001.
Dubai I 103.8 presents an array of independent expert opinions and does not advise one particular view. Always seek independent legal advice which considers your own personal circumstances.
Managing partner of Crimson Legal is in the studio, Bianca Grethius. You can reach out to her with any questions. We're having a special look at business setup, side hustles. We've had questions about corporate tax and golden visas. I'm confident we're going to run out of time. You can send us a message or you can do as Aftab has done and give us a call. How can we help you this afternoon? What's going on? Hello.
Hi. Yes, I'm here, Helen. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time here.
Oh, my pleasure. How can
I
help?
I have a question that's probably in the mind. It's probably in the minds of a lot of people. You see, there's a lot of questions going around in the social space, social media space, in regards to doing online sales like Amazon, maybe FBA or FBM or the like. Is it required to have a license? The e-trader's license is enough, or can we just have a residence visa and operate out of our, apartment? Something that, I would like to clarify.
Making sure you are covered for trading online effectively. All right, good question. Bianca, what do we need to know?
Thank you very much, Aftab, for the question. It's a very interesting question. key for you to remember is Amazon has its own rules and regulations for onboarding any vendors that it will have. Sometimes in some countries, Amazon gives exemptions, i.e. individuals are allowed to come on and sell. But in countries like UAE, they could be a little stricter. So if you're talking about Amazon, it has a different set of rules and regulations. If you're talking about other platforms, it could be very different. But if you're thinking of doing e-commerce, any type of online sales, commercial activity, my recommendation is get a license. Even if you have to get an e-trader license, start there.
And the e-trader license, one with a DD, for example, that can that's not attached to a visa, as you say. That's just the way of, you know, making money legally. And that starts from, I mean, I think mine was about 1,200 dirhams.
It's about 1,300, I'd say 1,200, 1,300.
I would go and have a chat with them. They're a super, super helpful. I went to the cafe at Palm Strip Mall. If you don't need a visa, so this is, I mean, in terms of side hustle, really, really helpful. They'll talk to you about business activities. They'll talk about legalities as well. And it's quite an accessible price point. But I think better to spend a little bit than be fined a lot. Would that be a fair takeaway, Bianca?
It would be. I would add one more thing to that, Helen. I would say in your terms and conditions on your website, whatever you are selling, make sure you limit your liability, because your license will not limit your liability. So you have to do so contractually. So make sure limitation of liability is one of the clauses that you must include in your terms and conditions online.
I don't know what you just said, which is why people need lawyers. All the very best with your online endeavours.
Thank you.
And give us a shout if we can help out any more on that. Right, Bianca with us through until 5 o'clock today. A message here saying, I have a golden visa based on salary, but I'm now out of a job. Can I still sponsor my older parents?
Yes, most definitely you can.
Now, older parents count as dependents. We also had a question that actually came through my social media earlier today. Can I sponsor my cousin? How about second cousin? That was from Pratik.
That would be quite distant. I don't think they would qualify.
As a dependent as such.
As a dependent.
Okay. I've had a message from Anonymous, and you can always be anonymous on the text line, saying, any advice on leaving a business license and visa provider early? We are being totally ripped off with fees. I mean, we said this off air. Ending and exiting a business can also be really expensive.
I think the question that the Anonymous is trying to ask, though, is about an agent. If you are talking about an agent who has helped you set up a business license somewhere, it's very difficult. And sometimes the prices can be quite high to try and exit those relationships. They do try and keep you in the relationship with them forever, because that means they make money every year that you renew your license. Mm-hmm. It's quite tricky.
What if you've done it direct with a business provider setup company?
If you've done it direct with the free zone, then happy days. You don't have to pay those extortionate prices or fees, if you will. You're paying no middleman.
Okay.
It's very different.
What about when you decide to leave the country and you have a business? I've seen this in the past, people going, okay, empty my bank accounts, got on the plane, not going to do anything about it. What can the consequences be of not properly shutting down a business before you exit the country permanently?
Now, it can be quite dire, because you can't have a business license without a general manager, and every general manager needs to have an Emirates ID. So if you can leave a company as a shareholder and be anywhere you like, it's not mandated for you to have a visa, but the general manager of the company has to be in the country. So it's very tricky.
Okay. I hope that helps anyone. 4001, your last chance to get any questions in to us. We've had a message here, Anonymous, and as we always say, it doesn't matter if you put your name on or not. Just want to make sure you've got somewhere to come for clarification, for some answers, action plan, peace of mind, saying a friend of mine has not been paid by the clinic she works for 6 months. The clinic has lost court cases from other employees they didn't pay, but they don't have the money. However, they are continuing to trade. I understand this violates bankruptcy laws. Is there any way that anyone can be held liable? Is this criminal and not just civil?
Well, actually, the employee, if it's an employee here that we're talking about, has direct respite or can make a claim directly with the Ministry of Human Resources. If the claim is below 100,000 dirhams, they don't have to pay any fees, actually. They go online to twafuk.ae, they file an online complaint, the ministry initiates the process. It's quite straightforward and simple. They don't really need legal representation.
If it's over 100,000?
Then they have to pay a minimum fee. That's a very minimum fee that they need to pay. It's quite simple.
Bianca with us today from Crimson Legal. Up next, we're going to talk about startup and SME-friendly banks. Is it better to have a business account, or can you put it in with your personal money? All of that and more.
Dubai Eye 103.8 presents an array of independent expert opinions and does not advise one particular view. Always seek independent legal advice which considers your own personal circumstances.
Joining us in studio, managing partner of Crimson Legal, Bianca Gratius. I knew as soon as you came into the studio and we started chatting and the text line started going bananas that we were going to run out of time. So we're having a little bit of a blitz on the text line and indeed some of the questions that have cropped up. Message here saying, what visa or permit should you take for a side hustle that will help them for payment gateway and bank account for receiving payments? So this is obviously going to very much depend on the business activity, presumably, Bianca. But does anything come to mind?
Exactly. It depends on what is your business activity? What are you trying to sell? And make sure that you're covered for it.
So here's my question about the money side. Why and when do you need a business bank account?
You need a business account as soon as you start receiving money from commercial sale of products or services. If you start receiving money for any commercial sale or products into your personal bank account, any bank in the UAE has the right to ask you questions.
Hang on, say that again. Has a right to ask you questions.
They have the right to ask you questions. They have a right to investigate your source of funds. Because your source of funds has to be known to the bank that has opened your account. It has to be clean and clear, if you will.
So, which then leads me to ask, are there any banks that are particularly SME or, you know, small business friendly that you found in your time?
Yes. I mean, I'm not affiliated with any of the banks, but
would be nice.
In my experience, I found a Rock Bank, and WIO to be extremely SME friendly.
Yeah, WIO is really good actually.
Yeah, and they match what they advertise.
Okay, right. Just a couple of last minute questions. I'm like, okay, but right, let's do it. Does a 21-year-old student with a golden visa need to get a visa for part-time work? Great question.
I don't think they'd need a visa, depending on where they're working, which jurisdiction they're going to work, whether it's mainland or a specific free zone, they may need a work permit.
And how would you get a work permit? Would that come from the family or from the business?
It will come from the business. Again, it depends on whether it's mainland or a free zone. For example, if it's mainland Abu Dhabi, Dubai, you need to get a work permit.
Okay. But in terms of visa, should be fine. Angie's saying, do DED license holders need to register for corporate tax? Last time I spoke to them, they said for DED, it's sole establishment. There's no need. Please confirm if that's still the same, anything new, or is there a threshold?
As far as you meet the threshold for any commercial activity income, you need to register. You become a taxable person under the definition of taxable person under the law. You meet the threshold, you need to register for a tax registration number or a TRN.
What's the threshold?
368,000 dirhams.
Per year?
Per rolling 12 months, yes.
Okay. Angie, hope that helps. I mean, great if you're making the money. Bad if you hate doing paperwork. What would your number one tip be for being legally covered, financially successful and sound for starting your own business in the UAE?
Get the right business license that covers your activity. Have contracts in place. And if you can't afford to get the right contracts in place, get good insurance.
Oh, we haven't even touched on insurance. This is a minefield. Just to say, I was talking about this earlier with Georgia Tolley, and she was saying she'd got a license because she moderates events internationally and whatnot. And it's, you know, quite serious events, you know, politics and crypto and da da da. And the closest match for her business activity is her trade license says Georgia Tolley, party entertainer. I need to see the business cards, some balloon twisting and more. Bianca, for anyone that does want to contact you, find out more about what we've been discussing today, as your advice was, you know, rather than going to an agent who's got literally, you know, skin in the game when it comes to advising on business licenses and visas, going to a lawyer instead. With your permission, if people want to send me the word biz, can I share your details?
Yes, absolutely.
No problem. In the meantime, Bianca Gratius, absolute pleasure. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you for having me.
Managing partner at Crimson Legal.
Dubai I-103.8 presents an array of independent expert opinions and does not advise one particular view. Always seek independent legal advice which considers your own personal circumstances.
And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.